Therapy Insiders is brought to you by Verve, makers of the Arc, a revolutionary neck pain relief and postural support device, available now at www.goarcnow.com, and by Edge Mobility System. Give your mobility the edge. Available at www.edgemobilitysystem.com.
Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I am Dr. Gene Chirac-Abrad here with Dr. Erson Religioso, minus one Dr. Joe Palmer, having to deal with some car issues. So, Joe, thinking about you. Erson, how are you?
I'm great, Gene. How are you?
Not too bad, not too bad. The riots are down, the weather is nice. So, Maryland's back on track, and the Orioles won today, so I can't complain too much. And
people could actually watch the game.
There's actually people at the stadium. So
nice.
That's always a bonus in Baltimore these days when there's people not afraid to be on the streets.
Or allowed to be on the streets, yeah.
All right, too soon. Let's not push it. I can talk about it because I live here, Erson. You can't, okay?
Okay.
Mr. Buffalo, yes. New York. So with the question theme here, even though you can't ask me questions about Baltimore, this episode is all about questions. Questions for us from listeners. And I know you get questions all the time on the Manual Therapist blog and when you go to all your courses that you teach. I mean, questions are all about. They're great, right? They're conversation starters. So we reached out on Twitter and on your Twitter account, my Twitter account, and what do we ask people? What do we actually say to people?
Well, I said it's an AMA. And for those of you guys who are not familiar with Reddit terminology, that's been something over the past several years where anyone from like a top Google engineer or a celebrity will go on to Reddit and, you know, from anyone can literally ask them whatever they want about anything. That's the whole ask me anything. So I just said, I tweeted out and also on my Facebook page, we're doing AMA, ask me anything on Therapy Insiders tonight. Do you guys have any questions for us? That's what I asked anyway. I don't know what you asked.
I don't know. Hopefully something coherent, but people actually asked. So
we're neither
Google engineers nor celebrities. So, but people still asked for whatever reason and we're going to give them answers. Mm-hmm. So the way this is going to work, you'll actually hear the voice of the people asking questions because we're all about giving shout outs to people. If you take time and actually ask us a question, we want people to know who you are and to acknowledge, especially if you're on Twitter. You know, I think having a conversation and getting your name out there is just as important as us blabbing our mouths. So that's the point of the show, is get conversations going. Right, Erson?
That's right. We appreciate the comments. And I'd like to be the one who says that this week because Gene always says it so professionally. It's like he actually plays a recording of himself every week saying appreciate the comments. So
we do
appreciate the comments.
I practice in front of a mirror. I told you that already.
That's right. And, you know, I think we got a lot of great questions tonight. So I'm excited to get started.
So let's get started. And the first question comes from at Cinema Air, with an underscore between cinema and air.
My favorite anime character.
And that is a reference to a previous podcast that Cinema joined us for. So if you want to know what that's about, check it out at Therapy Insiders. But here's the first question from Cinema, who, by the way, contributed four. So bonus points to you, Cinema. Question one.
Hi, Erson. What did it feel like when you first realized that you have more letters after your name than in your name?
Now, to be fair, I did not fact check that yet. I did not count your letters in your name and the ones after your name, but I can assume that you have a lot of letters after your name. So as funny as that question is, we can really have a pretty serious conversation. So Erson, what's with the letters?
First, I'd have to say I don't get the strange blowback on social media and then all the negativity regarding letter seeking. And you never see me complaining about that, right? Am
no,
I right?
No. Okay, nor well, do I hear you.
Right. Of course I wouldn't. So yeah, is it a marketing strategy? Sure. You know, and when people say, do patients not care about that? I would say patients don't care about that. And some of them do care about that. And that's fine. And ultimately it's about how you interact with the patient. And I think obviously there's a lot of posers out there, but I'd like to basically just learn from as many different people as possible. And I like to also get tested in their approach. And if I go all the way through a certain series like MDT or Paris or Rockabato or Rocktape or SFMA or FMS or Certified Strength and Conditioning or become a fellow, you eventually end up with credentials after your name. And there are some people who respond to that, and there's some people who don't respond to that. But I've never certainly had a patient tell me, you're too qualified to treat me, or I think you've had too much education. So again, I don't get the negativity, but you know, when I first started out, I would actually go through a whole series of courses every year and then get certified and kind of move on to the next kind of school of thought. And after a while, the place that I was working for just started complaining because they were printing out like hundreds and hundreds of business cards, and they kept on having to change them every 6 to 8 months. And then all of a sudden I would have like a second line on my business card because my name is long enough. Yes, it also has a third, you know, after the religioso, and then I needed like a second line, and I was like, just use a smaller font. So then I had a small font, and
that sounds like a nightmare.
I guess
I'm somewhere middle-ish to the other side. I think in an ideal world, it would be to three, you know. So me personally, I think the PT, DPT thing is a bit redundant. I think it should just be DPT, and it's tougher now because there's still so many MPTs and transitional PTs that, again, it kind of mirrors our profession in terms of we're scattered around with a lot of things, and that included. So I think once there's a couple more graduating classes and a couple more generations of PTs, and mostly everyone is DPTs, I'd like to see just the PT dropped and just have a DPT, right? Kind of like an MD or DO or DC or whatever it is. It's just a one thing. And I know one is your degree, one is your licensure, but scrap it, make a DPT, then have another one after that if you want, and the third one as the final one. You know, just, I know some MDs have their fellowship credentials behind it, and throw another one on there if you want, but keep it to three. I think that's nice and clean. Three is a nice pretty number. And you're right. I think I've had enough patients ask me what my, you know, OMPT or COMPT thing stands for. And it's a conversation starter. And, you know, some people that look you up on your website and see the extra letters, whether they know what it means or not, like you said, it's a marketing piece. So if it gets you one patient, I mean, what is a patient worth, Urson, in terms of marketing dollars?
Seriously,
on the spot.
I don't know. I mean, let's say I spent a lot of money on advertising. Yeah.
Let's say $1,000.
Yeah.
Right. So if a patient calls you because they liked your letters, I think it's worth it. But
right. I would also just say that I don't think anyone's ever not called, but I guess I wouldn't know because they didn't call me.
That just hurts my mind. All right. So that's the answer, Cinema, because we like our letters, but I agree. Let's keep it to a minimum. I say three. Urson says whatever, the whole alphabet. Let's put it on there. What do you say? We want to know what your thoughts are on the letters. So when you hear this episode, give us a shout out at Therapy Insiders, and give me a number. How many numbers? Hashtag alphabet and with a letter, with a number. All right, you ready for question two?
Sure.
All right, Cinema coming with question two here.
So, Urson, you've been cash PT for a little while now. What are the top three lessons you've learned since going cash PT?
Lessons, always a popular question. People always want to know lessons. So you've been, for listeners that haven't listened before, shame on you, give them a catch up. You've been doing, obviously you sell the Edge Mobility tools, so you have a tool business as well, but you also see some patients per cash, right? So how did that happen, and some stuff that you've learned along the way?
Well, I've always wanted to go cash-based, and then basically when every time I have a baby, I take a bigger and bigger break. And for those of you guys who aren't friends with me on Facebook, you wouldn't know that I have a whole wrangle of kids, as some listeners and readers put it. But I have four girls, and so I took off 3 months when I had my last baby, Layla, last February. And somewhere along the line, as it was tax season, I was kind of doing my taxes, and I thought, hey, I didn't realize that it was much less risky at that point due to my seminars and my products to go cash-based. Like, I didn't necessarily need to see a high volume of patients to feed my family and provide for them anymore. So I thought this is the perfect time to do it. So that's the genesis of that. And I never went back to my former practice. So I actually took off a little bit longer than 3 months. And so it's been about almost a year. I probably started somewhere between May and June of last year, seeing cash pay patients out of a gym. And I can't really say I learned a lot of lessons, because again, I don't see a huge volume of patients every week anymore, but I see enough. The one thing I learned is that as much time as I can spend with someone, and as liberating as that is, I really have to be efficient, because I don't have a secretary. I have online scheduling on my website, or I do the scheduling myself. And I used to freak out when I would see someone waiting for me for more than 5 minutes. Now, and even my patients know that if I'm 5, 10 minutes late, I will just spend another extra 5, 10 minutes into the next appointment and then into the next appointment, because I'm only going to be seeing between 3 and 5 patients that day. So no one's re ever really in a hurry, and they know that I'm still going to spend a time with them. So in one aspect, I would say I really enjoy how liberating it is and how much time I can spend with them without having to worry about a huge backlog. But two, I have to be more efficient. And only having a massage table in a gym, yeah, I have the whole gym's equipment, but then you miss certain things like pillows and pillowcases and secretaries and people to kind of keep the patients entertained when they're waiting.
Simple things in life.
The other thing I really learned is that, I mean, really, you have to have adopt that rock star mentality. And we've talked about this a lot in our Biz PT, hashtag Biz PT, podcasts, that you really have to kind of look yourself in the mirror, and you have to sell yourself to a patient more than ever. I mean, there are patients that I treated on and off for over a decade. I'd get them better, they'd come back and see me 1 or 2 years later, we'd catch up. And then, yeah, those patients who were very, very loyal to me and even referred all their friends and family to me, I had a couple of those just stop coming to me because, for whatever reason, they felt as if me going out of network, all of a sudden, I had lost all of the quality that I was known for, even though I said that I would spend more time with them than I had in the past. So, there's that. You'll lose people, and you just have to really learn you have to sell yourself initially. I mean, every visit, you're pretty much selling your approach and selling why you think this is going to work and why they have to be compliant with their exercises. And on top of that, before even someone goes to see you, you need to talk to them on the phone or talk to them in person at the clinic, and tell them why you're cash-based and what that means and their options. And that in itself takes a while. And then sometimes you spend 20 minutes before they basically just say, "Oh, I think I'm going to go in network. Is there anyone else you can recommend?" But there's that piece too. But I guess, I don't even know if I have 3 points for you, Cinema, because I've only been doing it a year, and it's not really a significant amount of time to reflect upon. But I mean, more so than ever, I treat my patients like customers, and I've always treated my patients like gold, at least for the past 10 years. And I didn't always in the beginning of my career, because I just thought I knew it all and I knew better than the patient, and that was just wrong.
Yeah, I think that's out of everything, and I know we've talked about this before with Jerry Durham, shout out. It's that mentality that I feel like for some reason, and I don't know when this happened along the line or if it's always been like this, that healthcare has stopped caring about their customers. Because I know the difference, and we've said this before, the difference between a patient and a customer is a patient relies on you and you rely on the customer, right? And that's how it is, and it's a relationship. We have more of a relationship than maybe retail or other consumer-driven industries, but they're still consumers. They're still customers that we have to help and support and hope that they sell our mentality, our skills, and our time that we spend with them to their friends, their family, and spread, you know, spread our gospel, essentially become evangelists for our brand. And if you treat them simply as patients, they don't do that. They treat you simply as a clinician. But if you treat them as customers, that you care about retention and you care about making them happy and not just, you know, hitting a goal of doing, you know, making them feel better, because that's your job. But what makes you a rock star is going to that next level of being, having that customer service, customer support, and caring about how the whole experience is. And it sounds to me like that being in a cash-based environment or even out of network, you have to really focus on that a little bit more than otherwise.
Right. I mean, I'm directly responsible for marketing to all my patients. Again, I don't even have a secretary to field their calls and kind of talk the practice up. And, you know, I could have all those things if I had a cash-based practice, but when I went out on my own, I really went out on my own. And it's rough.
Did you out on your own again?
Did I go out on my own again? What do you mean?
Did you go out on your own again? Like a rock star?
Is that some kind of like lyric?
I'm gonna have to find the clip of that song and play it so we get
here
sued.
I go again on my own.
Thank you, finally. Good Lord.
All right. God. Traveling down the only road I've ever known.
Sounds like the story you just told me.
Pretty much.
Well, I'm not going to be doing any more song references for Urson. On to question number three.
You misquoted it.
All right. Question number three from cinema.
The eclectic approach has been taught internationally for a little while now. I'm sure there have been many memorable experiences. Share just one interesting or surprising story from your teaching experiences abroad.
Please do share.
I think it's a great question. And I do get asked this a lot, especially by PTs in my home country in the good old US of A. So what have I learned by teaching in South America and the TUC of the USA, Canada, and more than just Ontario, okay, because I've taught in Ontario too, and that's pretty much just like a better Buffalo, at least Toronto, much, much better Buffalo.
Doesn't take much, does it?
In Philippines, and then I'll be going to Rome. So I haven't gotten to Rome yet, so I wish I had, you know, that's just a couple weeks from now. But what have I learned is I was surprised that everyone kind of had the same complaints. I mean, the people who attend my courses typically are pretty well-read and educated clinicians, and I've only had taught one course in Florida, actually, where it was right around Con Ed time, and literally it was one of the worst courses I'd ever taken, and, you know, it was supposed to go till 5, and everyone was done at 1. But other than that, I mean, the complaints that most people have, the better clinicians that attend my courses that are pretty much well-read and they take a lot of courses themselves are, you know, every PT in our country, the majority of them, they're high volume. They mostly do modalities. They don't do a lot of one-on-one, or they don't do a lot of manual, and all of it is passive care, and everyone gets the same, you know, kind of stretches and
right,
whatever.
Assembly line.
Yeah. And I was surprised though that what all the countries that I've taught, and again, this isn't a whole lot, I've only taught in 5 or 6 countries, it was always the same concerns and the same complaints about what they felt the majority of the profession was. And they just assumed that every PT in the United States was, you know, an amazing one-on-one manual, very well-educated practitioner. And I said, you know, I don't really think it's, at least in where I've taught and then, you know, where I am in Buffalo, there's just a lot of high volume practices. And I think that it's just a misconception that everything is better here, including the care. And I wouldn't necessarily say that's true or not true. I mean, I would just say that the better clinicians often have the same complaints. I think there's a majority, or I don't even know if it's a majority, but I feel like it is sometimes, but a lot of PTs kind of give our entire profession a bad name. When I hate it when I hear, you know, PT doesn't work for me. And I always just think like, well, the PT that you saw didn't work from you. But, you know, what I always tell patients is if you went to a bad restaurant, you're not going to say, I'm never going to restaurant again.
Some would.
Yeah, some would, actually. It depends, I guess, how bad of an experience you had.
My wife had a milkshake from Chick-fil-A once, and she had, you know, some stomach issues after that.
Not Chick-fil-A.
And
so I
swear to God, still to this, well, we still eat a Chick-fil-A, but still to this day, she has not had a Chick-fil-A milkshake because it had to have been that milkshake. And obviously, every single milkshake is tainted from now on. So yeah. No more milkshakes. So people cling to certain things.
Yeah, I do think learned food aversions are a bit different than services, but that could be true. I mean, you know, I know people who have been treated very poorly in PT, and with good reason. They would not think that, where they've gone to five other clinics, and they've all been high volume. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of poor experiences, have you had any just weird experiences as a teacher of the eclectic approach? Like, does anything jump out to you? Like somebody just questioning the bejesus out of you, or I don't know, any funny story that you can think of?
Yeah, like I said, I'm often surprised that I don't get questioned more in my approach, because the people who kind of turned me and kind of turned my tide in thinking to go lighter and to be more, to look at neurophysiology as the mechanism behind rapid changes, you know, a particular forum, which I'm not going to name, but if any of you guys are a part of that and you happen to be listening to this, thank you, even though for some strange reason you guys still hate me. or you know, you hate my ideas, but not me as a person. I get it. But I'm surprised I don't get questioned more, but I think it's the way I present it, you know, and I just say that you can make people question things that they've held to very close to them and their beliefs that make themselves up as a clinician without actually coming across as a jerk. So,
all right. So you haven't had anybody throw edge tools at you or try to whip you with an edge band?
Not that I know of.
Then we're done with this question.
I can definitely think of a strange story though. So
okay, go.
There's one woman who basically, she was asking me kind of questions here and there about just MFR and.
That's my fascial release for those of you that are not good with numbers and letters.
Yeah. John Barnesy type things. And I just said, you know, I'm not really talking about that, but you can ask me at lunch. So at lunch, she kind of waits. There's only a couple of people around, and I think these guys are blog readers, so maybe only two or three people got the chance to hear this. So she comes up to me and says, hey, you know, have you ever heard of MFR? And I had this experience with somatic emotional release, because I think at the time I had said something about somatic emotional release, and you know, the only people who ever used to cry under my hands were because I was being too rough and not because they had a somatic emotional release. And she's like, oh, you know, that really happens. And I said, well, that may or may not be true, but it only seems to happen at, you know, MFR and craniosacral courses. It doesn't seem to happen in any other course. So how could that be a real thing if the only people who teach it or that phenomenon is only happening at their course? She's like, oh, no, you know, what happened was, I was on a table and my back was injured when I was whitewater rafting, and then I ended up almost drowning. So what happened was the instructor was treating me, and then I started like writhing, and I started feeling as if I was drowning, and I rolled off the table and I couldn't breathe, and I was writhing all around on the ground. And then when someone finally kind of pulled me out of this imaginary water that I was in, my shirt was up much in the same way that I had lost my bathing suit. And then so she's like, she looks at me for like this light bulb to go off in my head, or like I'm going to have this aha, or like this is really a poignant thing that she said to me.
She's looking at you with longing eyes, kind of like shaking her head. Come on, agree with me.
And I just said, wow, that's an amazing story. But I mean, I have no idea what really happened to you there. And you know, the way I view somatic emotional release is I don't really know why it happens or if it happens, but if I saw something like that happen, I would run. You know, I wouldn't necessarily think that, because if you maybe we'll put some links up to some of these things that you may see on YouTube, but they're pretty crazy, you know.
And, agreed. It was to give a quick shout out to another favorite of our anonymous gangs to go with cinema is the awesome PT. I think his latest blog post about the crazy manual therapy things is pretty funny.
Yeah, like the myofascial unwinding. That is a crazy video. And you know what? Good stuff. I can't say that these things don't work, but I would have to also say that you probably don't have to have these things done to you in that kind of manner or experience a previous trauma that your fascia has actually somehow stored, even though it's like an inert thing and can't think for itself.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some neurophysiological component to all that. And I've done variations of it with various amounts of success, but I don't base my entire treatment over unwinding somebody. You know, yeah. Every person has a unique pathway that you can take them through in terms of not the unwinding, but the treatment itself. So some people, you know, you need something like that as a gentle range of motion almost. And some people don't. So don't unwind anybody. Be safe. Yeah. All right. Question number four. You ready?
That actually is good advice. You know, you never think like where this unwinding can take someone. You know, they can like end up writhing on the floor. I don't necessarily think it's very sanitary. I mean, I wouldn't want a patient writhing all around the floor.
No. And, you know, speaking of sanitary, one of my patients is a nurse, and we were talking today, and she's pretty funny. And we were talking about, you know, different hypotheticals. So, you know, in the hospital, obviously, it's clean, but it's filthy. So we were going back and forth with hypotheticals, and this one came up. If somebody said, if you put, let's say you're in the hallway of a hospital, right? And somebody said, if you stand on this one end of the hallway, if you put your tongue on the floor and just crawl on your hands and knees while keeping your tongue on the floor from this hallway to the next, and I give you $1 million, would you do it?
I've heard this question before.
I'm not surprised.
We've already... I think you and I have already established in private conversations that we're both germ freaks. So even you asking me this question is making me nauseous.
you're gonna go put hand sanitizer in your tongue right now, just in case.
I'm actually going to mute as I wretch. I'm gonna start dry heaving. Excuse me. I don't know. $1 million. That's a lot of money.
$1 million to go. I don't know, like 20 feet. Tongue on the floor in the hospital hallway.
In a hospital? No, I don't think.
Hallway. $1 million. No. $2 million.
Yeah, people catch.
What would be your number?
Iatrogenic diseases.
What would be your number?
I don't think you could pay me. I don't know. I don't think I would even do it for $1 billion.
Not for $1 billion.
Well, what if I just die? I mean,
that's true.
You know, that's.
All right, so there you go.
If I didn't have a family, maybe. But I'll tell you what, young single listeners who don't have a family or plan on never having a family, that stuff changes you. And
that's true. That's
I used to be quite the daredevil, and now you know.
That's true. He used to walk through hospitals. Now he doesn't even step in them.
That's right.
All right. So hypothetical, hashtag hypothetical PT. What amount of money would it take for you to do that? So
hypothetical PT?
Hypothetical
PT. Is that like our latest anonymous PT personality?
Hashtag hypothetical PT.
Not at hypothetical PT?
Not at hypothetical. Way to go. Now somebody's going to come up with that. All right. Question four for cinema.
Erson, you've been pretty active on social media for quite a few years now, and I'm wondering what has been the impact of social media on you as a professional, as a physical therapist, and on the business side of things also.
Social media, what you got?
Well, I talk about this a lot when I get interviewed about just business and social media. I mean, social media, it really changed my entire career. It's not a complaint, but I always tell people, look, I start off all, you know, thanking my blog followers at every live course that I teach, because if it weren't for people sharing my work on social media or reading my blog, and I would still just be teaching in Buffalo. And even though I love teaching in Buffalo, I mean, now I get to travel the world and you know, there's that. It's also, you know, made me realize that you really can't be as opinionated as you used to be. And everyone kind of, I think there's, if you know who Louis C.K. is, he's this great comedian, and
did you hear him on SNL?
No, I didn't hear him on SNL, but he has this great clip that I, you know, we could maybe even include on YouTube, but I don't know if he's on Conan or Letterman or something, but he's basically talking about the internet gives us a degree of anonymity.
Take your time.
Anonymity that
Boom.
People forget that the other person they're arguing with is also another human being. And, you know, it's easy to, I think, treat an avatar like a at something or even someone on a forum with that who chooses not to use a real name, which is a lot of people online. It's easy to treat them like trash and to argue with them and just forget that they're also a real person. And, you know, and I think even, I don't know if it was Pryor or Carlin that basically said that, you know, you may hate someone, but if you find out that that person who you hate hates you back, then you actually feel bad. Or you're like,
that's
hey, wait.
Yeah, that's a great line.
It's something like that. But, you know, I think people just forget that everyone deserves the golden rule, right? So, you know, when I first started off in social media 4 years ago, I reached out to people who were bigger back then. And I think they didn't probably even mean it this way, but they kind of just maybe emailed me, maybe didn't email me. But when I did reach some of them, they're just like, oh yeah, you know, I'm not interested in reviewing your product, or, you know, it seems like you have a nice website, but that's it. And they didn't share my stuff. And then that kind of just drove me to be more prolific and to just create better and better content. So people had to share my stuff because I just needed my product and my message to kind of get out there. And that just became a thing of its own, because the manual therapist really was just created just so I could mention the Edge tool. And that just, again, became a thing of its own. And now people say that I don't plug my stuff enough. So I try to maintain this delicate balance of plugging and content that is free. But really, you know, between my seminars and kind of my products being, you know, sold the world over and used by universities and professional sports teams and, you know, just great clinicians. But I mean, it's just that.
Good Lord. Yeah,
this is what social media has done for me. So I appreciate all the support, and everyone always, you know, I get nice emails all the time saying that I really helped out their career or their patients or whatever. So I really, really appreciate it. And I thank all you guys too, because I don't have to work nearly as hard. I mean, yeah, I work a lot in the more early morning and at night on my social media stuff, but I do get to spend a lot more time with my family. And to me, because I'm such a big family man, that is the biggest thing that social media has done for me. It's enabled me to spend more time with my family.
Your brood of girls. Yes. Those are great points. And I think you kind of describe the entrepreneur mindset, right? That's the difference between success and failure. Because when you're starting out and you're reaching out, and I had the same thing with, you know, when we're getting started with the ARC, we were doing our Kickstarter campaign. I mean, reaching out to media outlets and everything, you get so many no's that or no responses that unless you're so set in your mentality of success and believe in your vision, that's why so many people fail. It's a failure due to lack of just being persistent. And if you don't have that persistence and that belief in your success, you'll get beat down. I mean, it's, you know, you have to believe in that and you keep going. And like you said, use it as motivation. I mean, we did the same thing until we got picked up by the Baltimore Sun and Business Journal and all the, you know, bigger publications. So it's, you know, if you keep trucking at it, then most will get there. And even if you don't get there, at least you know that you've really tried and there's, you know, there shouldn't be any regrets aside from the obvious that you failed. Failure.
Right. Don't give up. Don't give up on your dreams.
Don't give up. But also don't just keep going forever and ever. Yes. Figure that one out.
Don't beat a dead horse either.
Yes.
But don't give up.
Exactly. But don't give up. Got that? Good.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on. So those are great set of questions from @cinemaair_.
Yeah, we have monopolized the podcast cinema.
Hey, you got prime real estate time. So next question. We got a few more. Trent Salo, I hope I'm saying his name right. It's either Salo or Salo, S-A-L-O, Trent_S-A-L-O. Here's his question.
Hey guys, it's Trent, DPT student from St. Augustine. Erson, I'm just wondering, if you could go back in time, knowing what you know now, and redo your whole career path, is there anything you would approach a little differently, or would you change as far as being able to get to the same spot you are today professionally?
All right, so we're going time machine style here. Thanks for the question, Trent. Anything you would change, Urs?
Well, this is assuming that you believe in alternate timelines.
You know what? We have a limited amount of time, and Let's stick to the question.
The time is a river, and I'm just throwing a rock in it. Okay,
we're not talking time. We're not talking True Detective Matthew McConaughey stuff here.
It's Back to the Future type.
Time is a circle. Okay. But we're going in the circle right now.
Okay. By the way, I went to St. Augustine. I don't know if you noted if you know that trend, but all right.
Shout out.
Yes. I think people ask me if I would take certain courses, if I wouldn't take certain courses, and I
would you still do PT? Let's start bigger than that.
Would I still do PT? Absolutely. I mean, I knew from the first day of even doing inpatient that I remember being so excited that I called my parents after my very first day of my first internship in a hospital that I said, this is what I want to do. So that is not something I would change. But I had to think about this, and I would say that even all the courses I've taken, even the ones I didn't enjoy, like if I speak out about something like, say, I don't know, craniosacral therapy and a somatic emotional release, it's not because I haven't taken it and I'm bashing it due to a lack of understanding. It's because I have taken it and I thought, this is not for me, or I just can't wrap my head around something that does not make sense scientifically, much less due to a lack of evidence. But
sometimes everyone needs a therapeutic hug, Erson.
That's right.
Maybe you shouldn't wrap your mind around them. Maybe you should wrap your arms around them.
I guess so. But
write that down.
But that would actually say that I'm touching them, you know, not to like, sometimes you don't even have to touch people to have that thing. So, but anyway.
Can of worms.
Yeah. I would say that I would, when I started getting into tissue work, I would go back and tell myself, don't beat on people. And you hear me say this all the time in my seminars, that if I could go back and apologize to the hundreds or thousands of patients that I bruised or beat the crap out of in the name of breaking up adhesions or deforming capsules. And
in the name of medicine and science, he did not physically abuse anyone.
I was getting results, but I also told people, you're probably going to be bruised. And I even told students, if you don't bruise people within the first week, you're not being aggressive enough. And that's one of the biggest things I would change. And then I would also just probably tell myself, you're McKenzie certified and you're manual therapy certified, go the McKenzie route more than the manual therapy route. And, you know, I spent over a decade of my career doing passive assessment and palpation for position and palpation for motion and palpation for condition, when in the end, now I'm just doing movement assessments and I do very, very, you know, very little palpation at all. And I did realize earlier on that I didn't like or do as many special tests as I. So yeah, it would be mostly stop beating on people and don't think you know it all, because you don't know it all, and treat everyone like gold from the beginning. I had to learn that. I was kind of a jerk to certain patients earlier on in my career.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much consistent with most people and most clinicians. You know, when I started out, that was a pretty, let's see, what's a good way of describing myself? I'd say I was a pretty good cocky prick when I started out. And, you know, I took Jim's course, Jim Meadows, and I took it as a third-year student, and I passed, and I did great, and I practiced, you know, my clinicals. I was practicing different manips and differential diagnosis. So I felt like I knew more than most, and to some extent, that you know, I knew different than most. One of my second to fill, it was at a rehab hospital, and I was practicing, and I was working on some of the clinicians, and then I was working on some of the nurses, and then there was couple nurses would line up, you know, during lunch hours, and then a couple more nurses, and then they would have to put in a, you know, a little memo from the manager of the PT department that students are not allowed to work on other hospital professionals. So they actually put that into you know, their daily operating procedures. You know, students were not allowed to work on other clinicians because it disrupted the flow or something. But that, you know, all that initially just kind of built up the ego to the point where working with other clinicians, you know, I felt like I knew more than them, and I felt like I could do things better than them. And that kind
the story kind of sounds familiar to me.
Yeah, that kind of mindset, you know, you might be okay with patients and they might, you know, they resonate sometimes, some do. But if you're working in an environment of other clinicians, that'll eat away at the at that environment. Then a year later, literally 1 year after I started working, we were just talking, and I sat with all of them, and I apologized to every single person for being a dick. And we had that conversation. I was like, listen, I mean, I thought about my last year, and I am sorry. I'm sorry for the way I acted. Don't get me wrong.
I never got a chance to apologize.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm still cocky. You know, I fight with that, the borderline between confidence and cocky. And I think it's a lot of perception, that borders between perception. But I think I have a lot of kind of internal perception of how I am. So I tried to, you know, really work on that. But that's something, you know, how you are around others, that's a big thing to learn, I think.
Yeah, I think another piece of advice I would tell myself is don't be afraid to tell a patient I don't know.
Oh, because absolutely.
If there's one thing that I'm pretty good at, it's I'm wordy. I mean, if you guys that haven't realized it, because I can blog every day, I can just tell a whole story and I could just keep on going forever. I could easily BS. I was one of those guys, if I didn't know a question on a test, I would just write in hopes that you get extra credit. And when I become an instructor, I laughed at that because you can fill a whole page with the wrong answer. It's still the wrong answer.
Exactly. But you can make it sound good.
Yeah, but patients appreciate honesty. And if you honestly don't know something, you'd say, look, I'm not exactly sure, so let me look it up and get back to you. And people appreciate that. You know, people appreciate honesty and transparency much better than BS.
Absolutely. Or even saying, listen, I don't really know, but this is what I think.
But
I'll look into it and find out for sure. I think people really, really like that. They want to know what you honestly think, but they want to know exactly the truth behind that thought. You know, is it backed by science? Is it your theory? Is it a concept? Is it a mixture of both? And people really like that. I mean, it's put yourself in that position. It's empathy, right? If somebody was telling that to you, how would you respond? Is usually how I think before I say something. All right, but not that you're getting wordy or anything. Let's move on to our next question.
Yeah, shut up already, Urson.
Good Lord. @Ryan_ATC came through with a question as well. Ryan is a third year DPT student at Ohio State, so here's Ryan's question.
Is a better understanding of the nervous system the next big step for shaping the how/why of treatment and physical therapy?
The nervous system, by the way, #DBT student, way to show up with the questions.
So this question makes me nervous.
Oh, I see what you did there, because the nervous system makes you nervous. Answer the question.
Definitely. I mean, if you read my work and you read the work of Butler and Mosley, you would know that absolutely an understanding of the neuroimmune system, as they are now calling it, is paramount to what we know, and in terms of, you know, what causes aberrant movement patterns or even pain as an output as generated by perceived threat, and how we can modulate different inputs and modulate and dissociate different, you know, the pain associated with movements, and how education, it works better than almost everything to empower the patient and really kind of set that stage and decrease their fear avoidance. You know, talking about all those things is paramount, I think, to understanding of why treatment works. Placebo, nocebo, all those things are very important to realize. You need to use those things to enhance your outcomes, not think that you should avoid them. You should embrace them. But also the understanding that if what we're doing is not truly mechanical, as in moving bones and having them stay in a position and deforming fascia, deforming soft tissues, or stretching nerves and having them stay stretched, or the stretch itself being the reason why someone gets better, as in like they were physically tight and now you just loosened up something by breaking collagen bonds, you know, if that stuff has pretty much been proven at this point to not be true, then we know that the changes we make have to be neurological. And I think that is the understanding that not only PTs, but any hands-on practitioner needs to know. And I hear a lot of, from different professions, not only PTs, I hear from chiros, I hear from massage therapists, athletic trainers, And they tell me that, yeah, their curriculum, whether it's an entry-level curriculum, a postgraduate curriculum, or they're taking Con Ed courses and certificates, and I even hear from some people in fellowship programs, yeah, they're still teaching pathoanatomy and, you know, palpation and, you know, traditional kind of putting a subluxation back into place, that kind of stuff. The profession's got a long way to go, and it's hard because it's an uphill battle. When you really embrace neurophysiology as the mechanism for why things work, it's tough. It's not like you can just go read therapeutic neuroscience education or take a Butler or a Moseley course and all of a sudden just change the way you explained every single thing. And that I just got that question asked by a reader today. You know, he says like he's embraced all that stuff, yet when a patient asks a certain question, he goes back to pathoanatomy. And sometimes you have to, because some patients won't buy it, and some patients will absolutely reject the fact that pain is an output from the brain hurt does not equal harm. So sometimes you have to be more like water and kind of, you know, be adaptive and just get the patient to buy into it, and then kind of gradually, after they trust you and you have a bit more of a rapport, kind of work into neurophysiology. I try to do it right away, and I think that's one of my downfalls too, because some people just need to hear pathoanatomy, and maybe seeing me 7 or 8 years ago, they would have had a better response to me kind of repositioning someone or correcting their posture or moving their facets. But now, you know, I just talk everything in terms of inputs and outputs, and most people get it, but some people I can absolutely see like the point at which they start to want to like check their phone or they want to get out of there. But for the most part, I think it wouldn't be such a big deal if the majority of medical professionals and even fitness professionals kind of really knew and bought into that concept of what we know, you know, why rapid changes happen.
Yeah. And I think the neurophysiological component of it is definitely big. And I mentioned Jim Meadows before. In Jim's course, it's very manipulative based, but it has a huge, huge, huge neurophysiological component to it as well, especially all his manuals. And Jim was taught by Syriacs, and, you know, Syriacs was very much, you know, pretty much most of the foundational stuff and what you're talking about, the pathomechanical, a lot of it comes from Syriacs. But Jim took it to the next level, and he added a lot of the neurophysiological stuff. And the one thing he always said in his British accent, by the way, have you ever met Jim Erson?
No, I didn't even know he was British.
Oh man, he's one of those. It's you bloody idiot, you know, one of the, like, there's no, yeah. If you say something wrong, you get beat down emotionally.
Is it charming though? Because I find people with accents can get away with things. Like Butler swears and it just sounds charming.
It is charming because he knows his stuff and he's abusive, but educationally so, if that makes sense. I mean, he'll beat you down, but he'll make you think and process things. But he would, you know, his big thing is always why. And he would ask you a question, and I don't know why this doesn't get asked much very often, especially if you have students or you're teaching residents or fellows, is why. Somebody will give you an answer and you either try to correct them or send them another pathway, but just simply asking why will stop a lot of people in their tracks, and they give you an answer, and then you ask them again, because they'll most likely give you the same answer with different words, and you ask them why again, and usually by the third time you ask them why, people will just stop and really think about it. And two things are going to happen. If the person is really, 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 really smart, they will tell you, I don't know. That's the answer you really want to hear from somebody that doesn't know. And you can't get mad at them for that, because they have a lack of knowledge, which is a learning, teaching moment, versus the people that just keep going and going and going, just coming up with an answer, knowing they're kind of like what we were talking about, is just coming up with BS, coming up with the wrong answer.
Like what you and I would have done a long time ago.
Oh my God, yes. I would do it. And that's why having, you know, learning from Jim was so great, because I would try and he would have none of it. It's, you know, shut the hell up. Why? You know, that's a great thing. And it's a good exercise, I think, for yourself, is if you're doing these techniques, do you ask yourself why? And that relates to the how. So if a patient asks you that, you know, most of them will buy into whatever you tell them, because as long as it sounds good. But if you honestly have that voice in the back of your head going, why am I doing this? Then you're in trouble.
Yeah, somewhere along the line, I remember doing ISTM or even STM on someone's lumbar spine. And I just thought, and this was years ago before I even thought about neurophysiology or changing tone instead of, tearing apart tissues. I just thought, why does this work so well? I mean, I didn't get it. I think it's one of the things I always ask my students or residents or anyone who I'm mentoring now. You should be able to answer why you chose a particular assessment and why you chose a particular exercise and why you chose a particular treatment, and even why you're choosing to explain to one patient the same exercise differently than you chose to explain another patient. I mean, and it better not be because so and so told you so. It should be because you actually have a good answer. And I think Mike Tankovich alluded to this. If if you don't know why, then it shouldn't really be part of your
Yeah,
treatment.
if you can't explain it simply, then don't do it. I mean, when I had time to take students, oh man, the first week, it's kind of like a frat. You break them down to build them up. I mean, it was painful to watch. I mean, initially, and not I didn't intend to make them hurt a little bit, but it was, it's that thing because they're taught, certain things, and you ask them why, and you really want them to get to the core of the question. The exercise is the same thing. Why did you choose 10 repetitions? Why did you choose 20? Why not this? Why not that? Because you go on autopilot so much, and this is a great thing to keep you away from that autopilot, which is so prevalent and I think dangerous, and not necessarily dangerous in terms of you hurting your patients, but dangerous in terms of you becoming stagnant in your career. That autopilot of, okay, I have a low back patient. We're going to do this exercise. We're going to do that exercise. I'm going to do this technique. I'm going to do that technique. And if you don't keep challenging your mind with why am I doing this or how can I do this better, you get on autopilot mode, and that's no good.
Why until they cry?
Why until they cry?
That's my neck. Next time I mentor someone.
That's right. Do it the Gemetto's way. Shout out. All right, last question again from our DPT gang. Shout out. You guys have been awesome, and gals, for all the questions and the conversations. So this is from at SF underscore Bay Area underscore SPT from our San Francisco gang,
Underscore, underscore.
the trifecta, the trio of Matt, Dan, and Anthony. So here is their question.
One of them.
Hi, my name's Matt Nobusada Flynn, and I'm part of at SF Bay Area SPT. And my question is, with direct access becoming more prominent throughout the United States in the last few years, what do you think the next step is, and how can we try to implement yearly musculoskeletal exams for patients to try to prevent future dysfunctions?
All right, so direct access, and this is actually a bit of a hot topic item, I feel like, over the last week or so on Twitter about yearly PT exams for movement or anything. What do you think, Urs?
Well, again, I graduated 17 years ago, and I remember
Yes, we
thinking,
know you're old.
yes, so old. So that's why I shaved my head. Shave off all that gray. So I remember reading an article that I thought was profound. It was written by an advanced magazine of all things, and it said we should really adopt the primary care and a dental model of two exams a year, not even just one exam a year, two exams a year. And I thought, well, of course we could be preventative. And that was before we even had data on PT being preventative and how to prevent future muscle injury. If you had hamstring strain or back pain, what could you do to prevent things, empower the patient, educate them, et cetera. We have more studies on that now. And I just thought, wow, that's great. We should do this. And I remember showing it to a bunch of PTs I worked with. They're like, I'll never, bro. We do, we're always going to be tertiary. And I'm like, okay, well, that's kind of the last I thought of that for a while. And I've always thought about that. And I even, how do I add having direct access? We've had direct access in New York since maybe 2005 or 2006. And at some points, our insurers just started covering it. So I didn't even really realize that until I opened up a practice with my former business partner 4 years ago. And we realized when we started reaching out to insurers that they would pay for it without a referral. So we just started marketing to our patients. And it was you know, if you don't market to your patients when they're your patients for return visits, you're not doing yourself a service. You can get a lot of return business. I've had people who say like, oh, you know, I came to you for headaches, but because it was, you know, one of the things as I was getting ready to discharge someone, I would say, look, if there's anything else that needs to be addressed, maybe you didn't tell me before, or maybe something just recently crept up, or you know, maybe you want to enhance your writing a little bit, you can come see me for that too. And some of them would say like, oh, I didn't know that. I thought I had to have a script. And like, oh, I'd absolutely see you for my knee, but I didn't have a script. But now that I know I don't need one, yeah, could you evaluate my knee? So I would discharge, you know, discharge their head and neck and evaluate the knee, and we would get paid for another evaluation and another round of care. So it's not like I was abusing it, because at some point I would obviously discharge the patient. But I think you have to discharge the patients, and I say, look, and tell your family and friends, your insurance company and all the major insurance companies in our area, they will pay for PT without a referral. We have direct access, and it's covered. And I think people are happy to hear that. And but you know, that's, I only know of that in Western New York, and I ask other places, and sometimes it's covered and sometimes it's not. So how can we get that implemented? I think that the data out there that shows, there's been several studies at this point that showing direct access to PT usually yields better outcomes, and it's on the order of thousands of dollars cheaper than getting what is considered first line care according to specialists, which is an MRI or some sort of radiation, as if that's care. Like, all it does is usually make people feel worse as opposed to better, you know. But yeah, it's at PT we have better outcomes, and I think that if you really kind of tell the payers that they can save money as opposed to this is has better outcomes, they should care more about the money than the outcomes, because they don't really care about the outcomes, obviously, because they're more likely to, you know, approve a shot in a surgery rather than PT.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing with when you're dealing with direct access, and we've in Maryland have been kind of spoiled, because it's, I think we have pretty much pure direct access, so to speak, aside from Medicare and Medicare and very few insurances. We're kind of like an open ground for direct access. And I've thought about the yearly PT visits a little bit, and movement is great. Yes, I know some people argue, well, you know, we need to define ourselves and we need to define movement. When we are what we are, right? We're good. We should be good at identifying movement dysfunctions. Obviously, movement dysfunctions don't always translate to functional loss or other pain or other problems. It's all in context. But I think the big thing that we're missing or not really maximizing on is other things that we're really good at that can be useful in a yearly checkup. Movement's fine, strength is fine, you know, exercises, sure, people can get some exercises. But what about heart rate? What about blood pressure? What about just exercise tolerance or their functional capacity for exercise, things like that, VO2s or exercise phys things. I mean, those are things that we can do that you don't have to be specialized as a sports PT. I mean, anybody can sit their patient down and take a blood pressure or take their heart rate or take their respiratory rate or listen with a stethoscope. I mean, that's stuff you learn in cardiopulm in school, right? Could you pay attention?
Yes.
Yes, that's right.
I would also say, though, that technically they are, someone else is supposed to be doing that for the patient. So I think
you're assuming.
Yes, I would think that the reason why we say movement is because we feel like we're the only ones who look at it, as opposed to other providers that they may already be seeing.
Well, not that we only look at
may
it.
May already be taking those as baselines.
Right, but
yeah,
we can also...
But we should do it too. I agree.
Right.
We should do it too.
We look at movement. I saw my primary... I had a different primary once like 3 years ago, and we were talking, and you know, I play golf and was playing some baseball. And so we were talking. He's like, yeah, so do you have any other issues? I was like, you know, my shoulder's a little sore from throwing. He's like, oh, let me take a look at it. And I was like, no, seriously, I'm fine. He's like, no, just
what does this hurt?
Just let me look at it.
Do that anymore.
I was like, listen, seriously, I'm fine. And in my mind, I'm thinking, if he touches my shoulder And I know I'm going to be disappointed. So I'm going to lose a primary care physician because I'll never be able to respect him again. And that's exactly what happened. He takes my shoulder and he, you know, brings it up into abduction and moves it around a little bit. And he's like, yeah, let me write you a script for PT. And I was like, well, you know, it's good that he at least went to that route. But, he wrote that like shoulder impingement or something. I was like, Thanks for the script, Doc. Great idea.
He's just trying.
But no,
at
thank
least
you.
He moved you.
That's true. He touched me. Yeah. So it's, you know, we do movement. We should be doing movement better or at least, you know, well. And it's, I think looking, especially if you look at the statistics of how many millennials are seeing their primary and, which is very little, or how many millennials even have a primary. So I think if we have a system where they're coming to see a physical therapist, because a lot of them play in rec leagues and play in different things, and if they come to just, you know, just to get checked out so they can participate and have fun, but then you throw in some of the basic tests like blood pressure and heart rates and things like that and have a history for them, I mean, that's something you can save somebody's life with. And it doesn't take a lot. So I think that's something that we can definitely play a role with.
I agree.
So that's
a lot of people don't see their doctor, I guess.
No, they don't. And, which is fine to an extent, I guess. But especially if you're young and healthy and nothing's really going on, but you should check in once in a while. I think it's always good to have baseline measures for certain things just to see how you're progressing. And you know, it's not going to hurt you if you have insurance, which everyone should at this point, but, it's, you know, can you afford it? And we get kind of put in the bubble of our daily routines of going to work or, you know, dealing with the kids, you know, doing stuff, whatever you have to do to pay the bills. I mean, you have a routine, you have a daily life, and sometimes, you know, to get away from that might seem like a bigger ordeal than it probably really is, but. You know, it's life is life, and everyone has their things to deal with. And sometimes the health issue becomes a reactive instead of a proactive thing. With most of us, you know, we react to an issue instead of being proactive and preventing issues.
Yeah, last time I was at the dentist, they were like, "Hey, did you get that upper left molar pulled yet?" And I was like, "Oh, you know, I just keep forgetting and this and that, and
I just keep driving in pain. It's
no,
fine.
That's the problem. It doesn't hurt at all." Right. So I forget when I leave. And I said, well, it's been about like at least a year you guys have been getting on my back about that. Right. And so she looks back at my chart and it takes her a bit longer than I think. She's like, we've been telling you to get that pulled since 2009, but twice a year.
You are a stubborn, stubborn man. A typical patient.
Hurt.
Typical patient.
I need some pain to remind me.
Well,
I have a complete lack of perceived threat about this tooth.
Have another kid. You'll have some perceived threat.
I will.
Five. Well,
I'm not trying. Let's just say that.
I'm not good with double negatives. That's just too much math. I don't know what that means. So that's our AMA. Thanks to everyone that participated. If there's anything that we missed, anything you want to know, if you like this segment and you want us to make this into more of a regular episode, let us know as well at Therapy Insiders. Check us out, therapyinsiders.com, at Therapy Insiders or therapyinsiders@gmail.com. If you have questions, emails, again, thanks for the comments. Thanks for the messages on Twitter. I mean, it's really cool to get some of the messages from our listeners that they like the show and are listening. It's good to know that there's at least four of you that
yes.
are tuning in.
We like to hear your voices too.
Yes, absolutely.
That's everyone good. Already knows what we sound like.
Yes, everyone knows and thankfully hasn't gotten too tired of it yet. So for Urson and myself.
One person even got addicted.
Really?
Yeah, there's someone saying they were addicted to the podcast.
They did.
Yeah.
Shout out.
It's a good thing we don't do it more often.
I know. Can you imagine that if we're too addicting?
Yeah.
That's kind of scary. I can't even imagine that being addicted to this. to this podcast, to this voice. Can you?
That's why Gene and I only do this once a week. We can only stand to listen to each other once a week. Otherwise, it would just be too addicting.
I have to listen to myself every day. Can you?
Me
can you
too.
Imagine that?
Yeah.
That's just,
no.
That I know, right? My poor wife. So again, thanks for listening. If you anything you want to know, hit me up at Therapy Insiders on Twitter, Urson at the OMPT. If you have more questions, again, anything we missed, let us know. So thanks for listening to the AMA episode of Therapy Insiders.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Till next time.
We're out.